What is going on out there? I mean, it is a fair economic question from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Friday today, the 27th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, I think one can fairly say that the theme of this economy this week has been, wait, what? Make up your mind. Because the economy is growing. Consumers, though, are nervous. Inflation is slowing. But the Fed is almost for sure going to keep raising rates next week. So here to help make sense of it all. And I do mean everything. Ornella Richardson, she's at ADP. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Ornella, let me start with you. And I want to start with the inflation numbers out today. PCE, of course, the Federal Reserve's favorite indicator, came in, as I said, lower than the previous month, 5%, up just a 10% on the month. Good. This is good, right?
This is good. This is good news. It means the Fed is doing its job. It's not quiet quitting. It's actually doing the job of moderating inflation. It's what we've all wanted. Now, I can be all sour-faced about it and say it's still above the 2% target, and it's worth mentioning that. But the progress is being made. So when it comes to the plus and minuses that we're seeing in the economic data, this is on the plus side.
Okay, then, Lynette, how come consumers are a little uptight and companies are laying off and everybody's going, oh, my goodness, there's going to be a recession in the middle of the year?
Well, I think it's a complicated picture, especially when you're looking at the tech company universe, yeah. Which is a mess of companies that kind of overhired during the pandemic. Yeah. A lot of goods were purchased in the tech space during the pandemic. And so now they're kind of deflating a little bit. So those numbers that you're seeing in the tech space are kind of, you know, it's siloed into that.
Particular area.
Look, so that's important.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Hasbro's laying people off. It's a toy company.
That's true. But toys are kind of another thing that were pulled forward during the pandemic.
Well, that's true. That's actually true.
A lot of things that are wonky that are happening right now are because the pandemic was a very weird economic circumstance where we bought a lot of some things and absolutely nothing of other things, like plane tickets, going on vacations and stuff like that. Like, it's odd. So, yes, it makes sense that this is a messy picture.
I don't know, Ornella, if you can actually answer this.
PCE is still...
Yeah, no, Lynette, go ahead.
It's still high.
Yeah, PCE is right. It is still high, right. 5% is still high, right. Totally. Ornella, let me ask you this.
It's still high.
It absolutely is. Ornella, let me ask you this. We have talked, it's been 3 years now that we've been in this pandemic, and we've all been saying it's going to take a while for things to iron their way out. But look, supply chains are smoothing out. Inflation is coming down. I guess my question is, how much longer is it going to be confusing? Is that an answerable question?
Yeah, it's an answerable question. It may not be the right answer, but I'll give it a shot.
You're on a roll today. All right, go ahead.
Do better than me.
Look, it's a complex economy, and it's gotten more complex because we're seeing structural change. That's the word economists use to mean that they're just not temporary changes or short-term changes. These are long-lasting changes. I'll just name a few, and we can discuss.
Sure.
One, labor shortages. They're going to be more persistent because employment is actually growing more slowly over the next decade than it is the previous decade. Supply chains, they're going to be a little bit more disruptive and costly because we're moving our supply chains to make them more resilient because of climate change and other reasons, geopolitical factors that have disrupted supply. Let's just stop at those two. That's enough to show you that this economy has evolved over the last 3 years, and we're still not sure where it's heading. So how long will it be confusing? Well, if you just give into the moment that the economy has changed, you're no longer confused. What we're seeing now is the new normal.
Wow, that was very profound, that last bit. Let me ask you, though, Lynette, about the labor market, right? Unemployment is at 3.5%, 50-year lows. Even the Fed, as it raises rates, is saying next year it's going to get to 4.4-ish, which historically is still really, really nice. And yet we're still all worried about people losing their jobs, which is a terrible thing, let's be clear. But historically, those numbers are very good.
hey, anybody with a lost job is someone with a lost job. And I can understand how people would freak out, especially when they're seeing these headlines, blue chip American companies laying people off. But I think what really gives people more anxiety is high prices. And we're still in a moment where that is a factor. 6% CPI is still high, 5% PCE is still high for the individuals and for businesses. And the Fed's not done yet. So I understand people freaking out about the labor market. It feels weird.
Oh.
If I can just add to Lynette's point really quick.
Yeah.
There she is. Yeah. Yeah. Just real quick. I think one of the issues is that people started talking about recession way too quickly. It was like buying Halloween candy in February and decorating for Christmas in July. And so every data point is it or is it not a recession? Look, jobless claims are still very low. That's how we measure layoffs. They're at a historic lows, and not every headline means that we have a labor market that is suffering. Of course, for individuals, layoffs are terrible. But in a macro picture, we're just not seeing in the data anything that's consistent with a big jump in job loss.
Okay, so look, I'm going to ask each of you this exact same question. And Neela, you're going to go first. And then Lynette, you have the benefit of hearing what Neela has to say. But the question is this.
Yes.
Do you suppose it's possible, given the GDP report, the state of the labor market, and signs that the Federal Reserve is probably going to slow down its pace of increases when it meets next week, are we seeing a soft landing in real time now? Neela?
We could be, and I'm not going to say it's 100% definitive. We could be seeing a soft landing, but that doesn't mean it's the best landing possible for the economy, because what I think is the real risk is it's not recession. It's that the economy stays slow and stagnant for a very long time. It doesn't dip into a downturn, but we have this very, very slow growth. The thing about recessions is that there's an endpoint. We reach a trough. The thing about stagflation is that endpoint could be longer lasting. So we still have to be careful here. A soft landing is no guarantee that we're going to see a robust economy this year.
Haven't heard stagflation in a while. Okay, Lynette, same question. Are we seeing one, do you think, in real time, a soft landing?
Again, it is possible. You know, it is possible if inflation keeps going in the right direction, which is down, and our growth continues, especially at the rate it was last quarter, which was not too bad, over 2%. Why not?
Oh my God, you can hear me just say I don't even know what she's saying. All right, Lynette Lopez, she's at Business Insider. Neela Richardson, she's the chief economist at ADP. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
have a great Bye. Have a great weekend. Oh, man. Wall Street clearly is not worried by much right now. Not the economy, not the debt limit, not nothing. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Along with that PCE report this morning, the Fed's favorite gauge of inflation, as you know, came some data on personal income and personal spending. And we've been talking since mid-pandemic-ish about how our spending has been moving from goods, that is, stuff, to services. And in fact, a lot of the inflation we've been seeing the past year or so has been services inflation. But the Commerce Department reported today that once you account for inflation, services spending was flat in December. Spending at restaurants actually fell. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, all that services spending we've been doing could be starting to cool off.
Restaurant spending is a category that Jennifer Lee keeps an eye on. She's senior economist at BMO Capital Markets, and she says it's an indicator of how consumers feel.
That is probably one of the first places to get cut back, you know, when times are getting a little bit tougher.
People have also been cutting back on other types of discretionary spending, says Kayla Brune, economic analyst at Morning Consult. She says spending on movies, sporting events, and other types of recreation has come down. Travel spending is still growing, but people haven't been flying as much.
Consumers still are taking those trips, but they're doing ones that are maybe within driving distance, taking advantage of those lower gas prices compared to earlier in the year.
Meanwhile, prices for a lot of services have already started to moderate. Michelle Meyer is chief economist for North America at the MasterCard Economics Institute. She says airfare prices have dropped, thanks in part to declining fuel prices.
And then restaurants, you're seeing some moderation in the rate of inflation there, although certainly not a decline just yet.
If demand for services continues to slow down, companies in the services sector might ease up on their hiring plans. Menzi Chen, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin, says that's not such a bad thing.
To the extent that there's still many job openings relative to people willing to take those jobs, then we do want to see some reduction in demand for labor.
Chen says that could take pressure off of wage growth and further slow down inflation, which is exactly what the Federal Reserve is trying to do. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Also tucked neatly into all of that data we got this morning was the personal saving rate for December, 3.4%, the third month in a row the savings rate in this economy has gone up. That number, by the way, is the percent of people's disposable income that they save. Just want to point that out. Anyway, what can it tell us about how consumers are doing in this late-stage pandemic economy? Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Just once, I'd like a piece of economic data to tell a story that everyone agrees on. X means Y. Today is not that day. I could tell you that the slight increase in the personal saving rate is a reflection of inflation slowing down. That's what Mingli Zong at the Urban Institute says.
Prices are not as expensive, so we don't have to spend as much as at the beginning of 2022.
So there's a little more to save. I could also tell you that the rise in the saving rate and the drop in consumer spending show that people are getting nervous. I'll let Gregory Dacko at EY say that.
It's extremely difficult for families to put aside money in this high inflation environment. They're being more cautious with their spending, and they're also trying to make sure that they put some money aside on a monthly basis.
Or I could tell you that even though people saved a little more last month, they're still really not saving that much. And Wendy Edelberg at the Brookings Institution says that's actually a good sign.
The saving rate itself is very much affected by what's happening to household wealth. So it's not unusual for the saving rate to be super low when housing wealth is really high and when stock market wealth is doing well.
Which is the case right now. When people are really freaked out about the economy, she says, they pull way back on spending and put a whole lot more into savings. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
a guy gave me $1,100 and a Ford Escape for it.
So that comes out to how much exactly? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 28 points today, less than a tenth percent, 33,978. The NASDAQ grew 109 points, 0.9%, 11,621. The S&P 500 up 10, that's points, a quarter, that's a percent, finished at 4,070. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow picked up 1.8%. The NASDAQ climbed 4.3%. S&P 500 advanced about 2.4%. Some credit card stocks rose as inflation fears eased just a bit. Sam Fields was telling us about how consumers are spending their money, right? So American Express added 10.5% today. It issued positive earnings and revenue guidance for the year ahead. Visa up 6.7% as it posted quarterly revenue that beat analyst estimates. Company's net revenue, by the way, rose 12% year on year. Stocks of some COVID vaccine maker took a hit after Reuters reported the European Union might cut the number of vaccine doses it buys. Pfizer weakened 1%. Moderna gave back 2%. But BioNTech, founder says it either way, was up 1.1%. Bond prices went down. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus went up 3.51%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been a couple of days, maybe a week, I guess, since we talked about the debt limit, Michigas, because we promised you we weren't going to do every twist and turn of that story, but it's complicated, the debt limit story. Not so much the politics of it, but the economics and the finance of it. So given the longstanding belief on this program that context matters, there is a crucial piece of context you ought to know as this debt limit fight plays out. First, though, a reminder on the size of the federal debt.
It's pretty big. It's the biggest it's been in history.
Currently stands around $31.4 trillion.
That's Kaylin Birch, global economist at the Economist Intelligence Unit in London. Libby Cantrill, she's head of public policy for PIMCO, the big investment management firm. That $31.4 trillion gross debt is the number everybody's been talking about because that's the debt ceiling, the limit the Congress will have to raise for the government to keep paying its bills. Bills that, as you've surely been told a bunch of times by now, here and elsewhere, that Congress has already run up. What we're going to talk about today is the composition of that gross debt.
So essentially, there are two pieces of that debt puzzle.
Kaylin Birch again. She's at the EIU.
At the biggest and most important is federal debt that's held by the public.
Debt held by the public is basically U.S. Treasuries, IOUs from Uncle Sam, held by banks, other countries, regular people like you and me, most often through mutual funds or pension plans or some other kind of retirement plan. That piece of the puzzle, debt held by the public, makes up almost 80% of the total debt. That's 80% of $31.4 trillion. Let me do the math. About $25 trillion.
The second part of the debt puzzle is debt effectively that is owed within the government to other agencies.
That's what's technically called intragovernmental holdings. Yes, a mouthful, but an important distinction. Money that one part of the government owes to another part. It is about 20% of the total, $6 trillion, give or take.
It's like the right hand lending to the left.
Or, put another way,
it's as if I lent some money to my husband. Now he has more money, I have less. But as a household, the same value is in place.
Now, you may well ask, why and how could the federal government owe money to itself, so to speak?
It's usually things like Social Security or other public services collect more in revenue than they necessarily need in a year. That surplus revenue is then invested in treasuries.
Just like a private pension fund or a bank might want to park money in government bonds to earn a little return, agencies like the Social Security Administration or Medicare like to put their extra cash in treasuries, too.
They need it to be as safe as possible.
That's Libby Cantrill at PIMCO.
U.S. treasuries, at least historically, have fit that bill. And as a result, the U.S. Treasury owes them money.
At least historically, in what Libby said there, that's doing a lot of work in that sentence because the American government has so far always paid its debts on time. That's why all those institutions and government agencies and literally most of the rest of the planet invests in U.S. Treasury bonds. It's that whole full faith and credit of the United States thing that we talk about a lot. And so the people and the banks and the institutions and the businesses here and overseas to whom we owe the $25 trillion of our debt held by the public are keeping a real nervous eye on Republicans in the House of Representatives. We return a lot of stuff in this economy, stuff that we have bought. $800 billion worth last year alone, that's according to the National Retail Federation. And that is a problem. It's a hassle for us, and it's a headache for retailers who, as Kristen Schwab was telling us yesterday, don't actually put most of their returns back on their shelves. It gets donated or thrown out or sold to third-party resellers, liquidators, as they're known in the trade. Everybody from big publicly traded companies to people working out of their garages play in the liquidation game. And you've played it, too, if you've ever shopped at places like TJ Maxx and Marshalls. But the industry is growing way beyond those household names as online shopping, which has a higher rate of returns, becomes more popular. So here's Kristen again with the rest of her story.
It's 9 a.m. and the box trucks are already arriving at American Liquidations in Connecticut.
So the one that just rolled in came from Amazon. This has a mix of apparel and shoes.
That's co-owner Dusty Lenga. His business buys truckloads of overstock and returns merchandise and resells them, not to everyday shoppers looking for a deal, but to other businesses, say scratch and dent stores or individuals. People willing to buy a full pallet of random goods, break them down, and resell them on sites like eBay and Poshmark. That's actually how Lenga got his start.
Through my first pallet, I threw it up online. I purchased it for $1,800, delivered to my house, threw it on Facebook Marketplace, and a guy gave me $1,100 and a Ford Escape for it.
Kind of an odd deal, but after selling the SUV, Lenga made a profit of $1,300, which he reinvested.
And one pallet turned into two pallets turned into three, started as a side business, and then just kind of blew up out of nowhere.
Lenga left his job as a private equity analyst a couple of years ago to do this full time. Today, American Liquidations has 8 employees and 40,000 square feet of warehouse space. It feels like organized chaos, neat rows of random goods from lawnmowers to hand lotion.
You know, it's a big risk to take on a space like this. It's a lot of overhead. It's a lot of moving parts that you got to figure out before, you know, taking that leap of faith where you're, you know, making a commitment to, with these retailers.
Companies like Target and Macy's only sell returned merchandise by the truckload. Lenga purchases up to 60 truckloads a month. Each holds about 25 pallets. And he purchases them sight unseen. So every delivery is literally a giant mystery box. He points to a section of items from Home Depot.
Sometimes we'll get home runs, and sometimes we'll just get a bunch of stuff that ends up in the trash.
What is a home run?
These are brand new doors. These things retail for thousands of dollars a piece. You know, someone who has a builder, they'll have material there to build, you know, their houses or do a project at home or even resell the items for more money.
Yeah, and what are the duds you've gotten?
Like these Christmas trees, like this is going to be a hard item to sell.
It's January. Christmas is a full year away. And the trees are a little junky looking. Their branches poke in all directions, like they've been used or were on display at a store. This is a big part of the liquidation game, finding the treasures buried in the trash. Across the room sit rows of pallets from Sam's Club. Each is wrapped in plastic, so you can only see the products on the outside.
Just a mix of a little bit of anything, anywhere from, like you'll see on this one, there's a Ninja coffee machine.
Ooh, hunter boots. Leave it to me to spot a pair of $175 rain boots in a random pile of stuff. But apparently, that's not the most exciting item in this pallet.
Bounty paper towels.
Oh, people love that stuff. Because Bounty paper towel, that's a $20 package right there, $25.
This Sam's Club haul has a retail value of up to $85,000. Lenga only pays a fraction of that, and his profit is around 35%. And remember, he's really the middleman here. He sells to people like Mark Dumshot, who's browsing at American Liquidation's nearby storefront. By day, he installs sprinkler systems. Reselling is his family's new side hustle.
Come down probably twice a day to see what they have for tools. The turnaround's like incredible. I can't believe how much stuff comes in and out of here.
Dumshot buys pallets, opens them up, photographs the items, and sells them on eBay. And lately, people have become curious about all the stuff sitting in his garage.
Where'd you get it? I can't tell you. I ain't giving out my secret.
The last pallet his family bought was shoes. He says they made around $10 a pair. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one of those tangential indicators that give us some insight into what's happening in the innards of this economy. A couple of reports the past couple of days about pharmacies limiting their hours. Both CVS and Walmart are cutting or shifting their pharmacy hours for a want of pharmacists. It's that healthcare burnout that we've been talking about since the pandemic was hot and heavy, just kind of a different kind. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Chevron reported, well, I think you can only characterize them as ginormous profits this morning. $36.5 billion for all of last year. That is more than double 2021's number. And it beat the company's previous record high earnings back in 2011 by $10 billion. Here, though, is capitalism at work. The company also said in its earnings call this morning that its fourth quarter gains, that is, again, October, November, December, had not met expectations. So traders soured on Chevron shares, off almost 4.5% today. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.